Interview with Harvey C. Kristen of Lockheed Aircraft. Wait, what was your final title?
Title was Quality and Reliability Director, although the nickname for the job was Fence Mender and Picket Painter.
All right. Were you ever an officer at Lockheed Corporation?
Never an officer. I was works manager of the P-38 program during the war, and involved with about every model Lockheed built. The highest level that I ever attained at Lockheed, you would call in our industry branch level, which is director, but not in the same sense as a director of a corporation. It was the director of a function, which reported to as a member of the staff of the president of the division. So it was down in the organization a few levels, for sure.
When did you go to work for Lockheed Burke?
Well, I first worked as a summer hire in 1928, went back to school, came back in June of 1929 on a permanent basis. Temporary job that lasted 45 years.
And that was in 29?
29.
Boy, things were happening in 29, weren't they? Where'd you go to school at?
Went Pasadena High, Pasadena JC, then now Pasadena City College. I'm a two-year junior college man.
Okay. Now, may I ask you when you were born?
Born September 7, 1910, on a little farm north of Green Bay, Wisconsin.
All right. And I would say that you have blue-gray eyes?
Oh, sort of a... yes, I'd say they're blue, but I do have a birthmark in one of them that would be a little brown carryover from somewhere.
That's a lot. Now, I think I just about covered. Oh, I was asking about Amelia's airplane. The exhaust analyzer was used
for fuel performance or for combustion performance.
It was not an exhaust gas temperature analyzer like we used to today.
No, not an ATG GT gauge like we use on a jet.
It analyzed the particles of oxygen and whatnot in the exhaust gas itself.
Maximized performance is what it was for.
Did it work in practice?
Well, that's a moot question. There have been many claims for them. I think what they did is they indicated when you were in your extremes. I think they were a backup more than anything else. I've not known too many people to have absolute reliance upon them, no.
Well, Amelia was using it, and she spent quite a bit of time in Batavia, Dutch East Indies, getting it prepared evidently, she didn't feel that she could lean the mixtures properly without its use. I know that when I talked to Dick Merrill, he'd gone to the automatic mixture control unit and trusted that, which is we all went sooner or later, but Amelia had gone to the manual control with the casting. They were not as reliable. They were a great theory, but did not work in practice quite that.
No, I always thought of them as backup for getting into the extreme modes or extreme conditions where if other things were not operating properly, at least had a backup indicator. But I don't recall our pilots having too much reliance on a fuel analyzer other than an indicator.
Well, I'm assuming in my computation...
That's a personal, by the way, that's just a personal memory of the thought of the situation.
I am using as a basis for computations of her endurance, the assumption that she could come within 5% of the best fuel consumption possible. She could do no better than that, but she could come within 5% of doing the optimum. Does that sound reasonable?
Well, I think that's a very, I think it's an optimistic figure, but I certainly don't think it's an impossible one. I recall the factors that people used to crank into their flight plans, and I would say it would be on the optimistic side, although certainly with her ability and her meticulous training that she went through for all of these ventures she went in, that she'd be as equipped to meet that criteria as anybody would from the standpoint of knowing how to handle the equipment. But as to whether the equipment could give her feedback that she was indeed performing within that range, I wouldn't think we had that capability at that time.
5% of optimism.
It's a little optimistic. It's a little optimistic, I would think. That's just, again, a layman's opinion based on the relationship you have through the years with people as they work out these plans.
Now, when this airplane was originally being built, do you remember that you were building it for a Meteor-Hart?
Yes. We knew right from the outset we were building it for a combination of Purdue University and Amelia on a foundation or on a project or a program. Yes, we knew who it was for.
Okay. Did Amelia come out to the factory during?
Oh, yes. My relationship with Amelia goes back to, and as a school teacher, as we used to say, she flew the old Vega, which she entered in races, cross-country, closed course, and then flew the Atlantic. It goes back to that airplane. Goes back to that era, and naturally she was a very welcome, wonderful lady when she would show up at our facility at Burbank. And as I recall, I think she was the pioneer of some other things too, including the very popular today pantsuit that we see our women wear. I think she was one of the first lady pilots that would come to the plant in a neatly tailored and wonderfully practical uniform.
It was practical, crawling around airplanes and up ladders and whatnot, wasn't it?
Yeah, between that and a nice white pair of coveralls, which she got soiled with the rest of us in a hurry as she prowled around her airplane and assisted us in kind of inspecting and checking. She was not adverse to being part of the team that built the airplane at all times.
You liked her, didn't you?
Absolutely. Beautiful person. She was had an infectious smile, a beautiful personality, and I believe a total commitment to whatever she set out to do.
What do you think she was doing?
Well, in my book, she was doing her best to make a contribution to our country first, our industry second, third to all the gals that were her peers of the day. Like we always relate our Lockheed airplanes to wonderful gals like Ruth Nichols, Amelia Earhart, Laura Ingalls, Ruth Nichols, Amelia Earhart, and we had still another that did so much work. Jacqueline Cochran with the 104 and others later, but I'm thinking now of the days of the single engine, Plywood, Orion, Altair, Air Express. Media, in my book, relates to the days when the Bendix races and the closed course races that were so popular in our country began to bring the ladies out to into the open as competitors and as very capable pilots. The other girl I'm thinking about was a Smith girl that flew a Vega back in the East. All of these girls were related to research projects. None of them were just totally flying just for the fun of flying. They were all trying to make a contribution to the industry or to the science or whatever you call it. So Amelia was a standout in that area. She was always sitting on the end of a bench in the shop with a crew chief, a pilot, an engineer, and did her share of dreaming with the rest of us about the future of our great business, our great opportunities.
During the construction of the airplane, later any modifications, anything done, was there anything done to the airplane or done preparation for the airplane in any way that you consider would have been for some...
Getting down to nuts and bolts of the practical things, whenever you take a basic airplane and you start cutting holes in it for fuel filler lines and for navigational aids and antennas, etc., you're always reinforcing those immediate areas. So therefore, When you do cut into a fuselage, a wing, or any of the basic structure of the aircraft, you found yourself replacing the basic strengths of that fuselage in the areas that might be affected by these add-ons, and so therefore you were constantly modifying a basic airplane as you went through these add-ons and changes to the add-ons. And your airplane certainly went through its share of that. So I would say during the latter final assembly and test stages at Lockheed, plus the efforts by these various equipment suppliers in the East and at the Paul Manch facility, that there was a constant involvement with modifications that required, in many instances, engineering approvals and basic, let's say, stress checks or analyzing before you went ahead and pronounced it as good or better than it was before you cut a hole in the fuselage, put a door neck in. So therefore, we were doing a certain amount of modifications and beef ups, as we'd call it.
Do you know the airplane have any CG problems as far as the fuel tank that she installed, or that been very carefully engineered?
Well, first of all, the center of gravity is a moving thing, depending on how you use the useful load you've got on board, as I understand it, and how you distribute your fuel and how you use your fuel. So I've always felt the CG was a very, it was a...
With full tanks, was she right on the rear CG limit?
Well, she had tab control. She had abilities to control that airplane that would, again, now you're getting into aerodynamics, you're getting into a phase I'm not qualified to respond to you in, but I have never, in the time that I was related to aircraft, heard of any case of one, a problem of center of gravity or a condition where it would be hazardous to a takeoff or a landing, or have I heard of any aerodynamic characteristics that developed as a result of what she did to it that would be of any kind of a deterrent?
She did crack the airplane up in harm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Now, it was on takeoff.
Right.
And the airplane started to swerve to the right. She pulled back the power on the left engine to correct it. It got going into a swerve to the left that she couldn't stop. And the airplane ground looped, and in the process collapsed first the right gear and then, I guess, the left gear.
Sure.
Do you remember the damage that was done to the airplane particularly?
Well, I remember seeing the airplane come back with the nacelles crushed. I'm not familiar with whether the gears collapsed back up into their wheel wells or whether there were some side loads that might have caused them to...
There
were side loads. I did not witness, or I don't recall. But at any rate, the airplane was not a ground-looping airplane. The only thing I can think of with the fuel loads and all of the critical, I would think, and you'd know more than I about this, phase that you get into on a takeoff, that the element of control between the surfaces and the brakes would be quite a racy course.
Okay, I'm going to suggest something to you, and this is interesting, I found an accident report that the United States Army Air Corps had done on that accident, and I found it buried in an old Hawaiian Army file, and there was about 10 eyewitness reports, plus there was a complete rundown, minute by minute, of everything that had been done to that airplane. From the time it arrived in the Hawaiian Islands until it cracked up, and then on until the time it was eventually shipped off, including the most beautiful part of all, a complete inventory of everything that was in that airplane, this little lieutenant, every pencil, every eraser, every serial number, every model number, and it was what a magnificent find, because it listed everything, every book that they had, everything. Well, in the report, and also had a beautiful picture of all the tire marks. You might have heard that the tire blew. Had you heard that?
No, I had.
Well, it did not blow. The marks showed positively that the tire was inflated until the very end. If the tire would blew, it was after, during a collapsing phase, when it got side loads it couldn't take. But that was not the cause at all. The swerve. Did you know, did anybody inform you, did Mealy ever tell you that the right-hand propeller had frozen about halfway between Oakland and Honolulu?
No way. Didn't hear. No, I'd never...
It had.
I might not have been privy to that information, but...
She never mentioned that.
I'll be darned. So she might have had a pitch problem, huh? Pitch control problem?
She did. They had a...
Was it a governor? Was it a constant speed prop?
It was a constant speed prop, counterweights versus...
Sure,
pressure.
Sure.
About halfway across, it froze, and they couldn't control it anymore, and it stuck, and this was a fixed pitch prop from that point on. Luckily,
yeah.
They were in a cruise mode, so it didn't matter much.
Yeah.
When they got in, Paul Mance reported, they got some men working on it. They worked all night on it. They had an awful time with it. They even gave the reasons for why it froze, and they repaired it and broke its cloth and whatnot, and re-greased it and whatnot, and checked it, and seemed to be free. But it took them all night long to get it apart.
Something had seized or galled it in there.
Yes. And they felt that they'd fixed it up so it wouldn't stick anymore. And, but they didn't know what the little pitch stops
were. Oh, I see.
So they measured the blade angles on the other prop, which they hadn't taken apart, and then they made the right one match the left one. Using a blade
protractor, I guess. Protractor, old-fashioned protractor, yeah.
Anyway, it's a feasible, or it's in the realm of possibility. In fact, it's a good realm of possibility that they did not get the high pitch, low pitch stop set properly. So when she applied full power, the engine did not develop enough RPM on the right side. It was a little too coarse, and it did on the left. And so the airplane would slowly start to veer off to the right. As you know, as long as the tail wheel was on the ground, she had quite a bit of leverage back there to keep it going straight. It was locked, but she tried to lift the tail up. Now this difference in power would slowly turn her to the right. And
sure.
Until she got the tail up in the airspeed, up above whatever BM, well, it wouldn't have to be BMC, but until she got a good airspeed and a good rudder control and got the tail up out of the water,
yeah.
She would have a tendency to veer off the right. There was practically no wind at all. It was only 1 or 2 mile an hour wind, so the wind was the main factor. So when it started to veer to the right, she couldn't correct her rudder and match her tendency, and the correct thing to do would be to pull the power back from the left. She overdid that a little bit, which is very easy to do unless you were quite an experienced multi-engine pilot. While she was a good pilot, she wasn't really all that experienced multi-engine.
Right.
And it got going to the left faster than she could stop it. Once it got going, why, it's practically impossible to stop.
Sure.
And
so it could have been the propeller that caused the incident then.
Well,
could have been.
It could have been. Well, I have pictures. I have all photographs, very excellent photographs. Now, the blades are all bent forward, which to me indicates positive power on when the gear collapsed. She had
sure.
Still had her power. Whether we could somehow measure blade angles and whatnot, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I just wondered when you brought it back to the factory, did you check anything?
No, we would have taken the propellers to the prop shop immediately, and the engines would have gone to an engine like, I'm assuming now, like Pacific Aeromotive. Yeah, because they would be the only ones equipped to run that.
No one ever did an accident investigation at all.
No, I wouldn't. Those days we didn't have this great immediate response system we have now.
Well, the fire marks and everything indicate it looks like it's a good possibility.
Yeah.
What happened. Or possibly the propeller decided to fall again and then it just not wasn't free to get into its full Well, that was
yeah. Yeah. Well,
no. Okay. So you're getting antsy.
I'm beginning to look at my watch.
All right.
Yeah.
Fine. The only thing I would. I think it's a book, by the way.
No.
I'd like to read it. And on page 70 of this book, it talks about you and some of the other fellow Lockheed. Says here, during these 2 months, I was seemingly busier than ever before. Nearly every day, there were hours at the Lockheed plant, consulting with engineers Hibbert, Gerstler, and Johnson, or checking into the 1001 details of the rebuilding with Herr Harvey Christen and Furman Gray in charge of the job, etc.
Furman Gray was actually the foreman in charge of the job.
Is he still there?
Yes, he lives in Fallbrook area, down near San Diego. Furman Gray. Yes, he's very much active and very much alive, doing what a good retiree does. He's an avocado farm, yeah, Fallbrook, yeah. He's still going.
Hey, I want to ask you, by the way, let's give this book to you. You'd like to have it.
Well, sure.
It's for Latin Reply. Just yeah. Paper
thank back. You, thank you.
Now, I want to ask you two things, point blank. One, do you think, to your knowledge, that there is any reason that you believe that Amelia was doing anything besides just trying to be the first woman to fly around the moon?
Well, I said earlier, to make a contribution to the field of the air. She's a pioneer gal all the way through. The answer would be no. I don't think she was doing anything other than making a contribution to the female side of our business and to the industry as a whole, or to the... I have no reason to believe otherwise.
And no, there was no modifications to the airplane that would have allowed it to become a camera?
None that I would... I certainly feel I would have been aware of it, but I'm as sure as I could be that it was not that kind of a mission.
Well,
and I might say that I have... My feeling in this has been constant since the day I was asked the first question. As long, I guess, as 10, 15 years ago by folks, I've always maintained that Amelia was not doing anything other than working in the field of the air on a project or program that she thought and was convinced, or she wouldn't have taken it on, would make a contribution to the business.
In ditching the Lockheed, now she would have had no reason to have ditched the airplane. We must remember this is in the mid-30s,
sure.
Before we had a lot of experience. By the way, she had a life raft on Moya. And the life raft, according to drawings that I found, was stowed back in what used to be the John.
Aft.
And along with a bunch of other things back there. On the starboard side of that room, there was a window. Was that an escape hatch also?
Well, the escape hatches in a normal 10E were more mid-section of the fuselage. Some instances, the door was also designed as a escape cabin door. In some instances, was designed so that it was a quick release type door. But no, I don't recall or. And all is positive that unless it was specially put in for her, there would not be an escape hatch right there.
Okay. The only reason I ask that is in Miami, I have a picture taken of Amelia on the starboard side of the airplane, and it doesn't appear to be any window there at all. What I mean is it appears like there's a hatch is open, or the glass has been removed.
Sure.
All the other pictures of the airplane that were taken for the rest of the flight all the way through are... skinned over, or it was maybe they broke the window accidentally. They didn't have anything to replace it with, so they replaced it with metal.
Do you know anything
about it?
No, but why would a person put a raft in the back of the airplane without a method of getting it out of the aircraft and hurry if need be? Huh?
Well, maybe we didn't think very well in those days about actually ditching.
There might have been something put in as a modification back there that would allow. Someone in the back end to get that hatch out, but I can't see if anything other than an add-on modification back there that would made an escape or an exit of that type. No.
Okay. One other thing. When you changed, or there's two other things I've got to get to. When you prepared the airplane, I have all of her weight and balance before the crack-up. Afterwards, I don't. I haven't been able to come across it. Probably in the process of repair and whatnot, some weight was probably added to the airplane.
Well, generally, the weights that would be added would be if you had to, instead of replacing a skin, you put a doubler on to reinforce the damaged section, or if you put added stringer in to support an area that had been damaged. If you didn't go back to the basic frame and start over, which in most cases, if it's severe enough, you do, rather than scab on a lot of patches. The practice is to not add extensive weight to an aircraft as a part of repair, because you would throw the configuration off. So I would say that we probably went right back to basic stringers and ribs and skins where it was severe enough to do so, and where you would add weight by adding doublers or reinforcements, it'd be minimal.
So you think even 100 pounds would be quite a bit?
Oh, yes. I wouldn't think it would be that much, because it isn't customary to throw that much extra weight.
Adding 25 or 30 pounds to the new zero fuel weight, it might be a reasonable assumption.
I wouldn't even hazard a guess as to that, because it depends on the extent of the damage. If the wing spars and the attaching points of the landing gear needed a reinforcing plate, depending on what was required, that would have to be taken into consideration.
Okay, there's one other something way out in left field. I almost hate to bring it up, but I don't
know
how
right.
You feel. And that is, I just got back from Washington here a month or so ago when the F-16 received the Collier Trophy Award. And I remember, I think it was 1938, when the Lockheed first pressurized airplane received the Collier Trophy.
XC-35.
This was a design philosophy follow-on to the Lockheed 10. Is that correct?
It was a 10. Fuselage, especially designed and built to fit into what would be the nearest thing would be a 10E type aircraft. It had external General Electric superchargers, and it had a completely circular fuselage rather than the typical Electra design or 10E design. And the controls, the surfaces, the wings, and the tail end were primarily Electra. No, it was the fuselage that had the basic.
There is a suggestion that that airplane was used by Amelia out of Ley, New Guinea. I've been to Ley, New Guinea.
No.
Talked to the people who are there, and I have pictures of her takeoff. Absolutely not. But do you know what the XB-35 was?
XC-35
was doing in?
Well, the XC-35, as far as I know, was a Dayton, Ohio test airplane. Today, it's somewhere under the control of the Smithsonian Institute. Just about 10 years ago or more, I helped scrounge up some drawings for the Smithsonian to bring it back to exhibit condition. As far as I know, the budget for doing so has stalled it, but the airplane is somewhere in the hands of the Smithsonian today. Beyond the testing that we did, and they did at Wright Field, that's the extent of my knowledge of the aircraft. It had no program that took it beyond that point, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, there was an airplane that belonged to some of the boys over at Edwards Air Force Base that crashed, and a couple of them were killed. I think there had been a little drinking going on. I'm not sure of that, but it crashed and burned over near Daggett, California, somewhere. Are you familiar with that at all?
Well, when you say
it was a Lockheed,
you're talking about people now and their personal problems. I'd rather not enter into that discussion, because I know nothing about it. The only thing is that it was not uncommon for privately owned Lockheed 12s and 10s. Paul Mance, I think, had one. Mercer Airlines had one. They were privately owned airplanes, but most of them were 10, 12.
The point I was really trying to make, I could only see a picture of the wreckage. It was burned quite badly and whatnot. It had the same end number. It had 16020, which was, of course, maybe it was NR, because it's a restricted category. But from what I could see of the airplane, it didn't look like a Lockheed 10 to me.
If I recall, if we're thinking about the same incident, I believe a Model 12 going in up there. Yeah, that would be a Model 12 aircraft. Now, I don't know about the tail number. Do they repeat the tail numbers on varied models aircraft, or do they once used never use it again?
For $25, you can get any
number you want.
Number you want that's available.
Yeah.
Frank Sinatra uses everything, getting an FS. Yeah. Flying Tigers uses everything.
Yeah.
Using FT and MPA.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
What does that have to do with the media that's been in the desert?
You'd be surprised what you're up against. These people can tend
to... Now we're getting into the side of the business I'd prefer not to talk about.
Yeah. By the way, you can talk to us if you're interested. Well,
okay, that's the end of the Furman interview and of the Harvey C. Christen interview. Side 2 may have been done before side 1, but anyway, it's all here on one tape now anyway.